Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Your Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for, well, an intelligence briefing on what I think of as the war for the free world. One of the more interesting and potentially dangerous parts of the war for the free world at the moment, of course, is what's playing out in Ukraine and Russia and that part of the world as it is seen by Vladimir Putin and his friends. Interestingly enough, a new book has just come out by a mega best-selling author by the name of Stephen Hunter, entitled Sniper's Honor, which seems uncannily, almost eerily set against the backdrop not only of today's events, but of those of many years before. We're delighted to have him back with us. Stephen, welcome. Congratulations on this gangbusters new book. I'm partway through it, but reading it feverishly as I can't put it down. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be with you again.
Give us a little bit of a flavor of the plot line of Sniper's Honor, and then we'll talk a little bit about, you know, the contemporary setting.
This is another Bob Lee Swagger book. In this book, Bob goes to Russia and ultimately Ukraine to help his friend Kathy Riley of the Washington Post look into something that she's learned about, which is that in 1944, the Soviets sent a female sniper on a secret mission. She evidently failed, but not only did she disappear physically in the melee of combat, but she also disappeared administratively, as the Stalinists were wont to do. They erased her records, they erased her medals, they erased her actions, they painted her out of all the pictures.
The Trotsky treatment, in other words.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so Kathy and ultimately Bob become very interested in what happened to her, and they begin to investigate, and as soon as they begin to investigate, people start trying to kill them. So the first question is, what happened 70 years ago that is still worth killing about today? And the second question is, what happened in 1944? And the book is set in two time frames. It flashes back dramatically, I hope, between Bob and Kathy having Ludlam-like adventures in modern Ukraine and Billy Petrova fighting with the partisans in the Carpathian Mountains in 1944. I love World War II. I mean, it's a massive tragedy. There's no doubt about it. But also, it's a tapestry of sacrifice and gallantry and commitment and, human purity, if you will, heroism beyond measure. And it was just so exciting to get back to that.
Well, and I just have to say, the character Bob Lee Swagger is such a specimen, and your ability to bring him to life, in particular through your incredible detailed knowledge of firearms and his mastery of them, is a marvelous sort of prism through which to treat, as you do so well in book upon book, these historical tapestries, as you call them. Stephen, let me ask you about your acknowledgement in the book. You thank the person who you credit with having turned you into a Ukrainian partisan, Kathy Lally. Tell us a little bit about the backstory there.
Well, Kathy was the features editor of the Baltimore Sun many, many, many years ago, back when Tyrannosaurus Rex prowled the earth. And she helped me advance from grim, seedy little incompetent copy reader to film critic because she believed in my talent. Years later, you know, journalism careers twist and turn and rise and fall. We ended up together on the Washington Post, where I was the film critic and she was the Soviet, the Moscow correspondent. And I have traveled to Russia twice to visit her, a very good friend of mine. She and her husband and my wife and I are very good friends. And I asked her, I actually put it to her, where should I set this book? And it was her selection of Ukraine that paid off all. And people keep saying to me, God, you're so brilliant that you figured out years ago that this would be the world's hotspot. Now, I, of course, you know, nod sagely and accept their tributes to my genius, knowing all the while that it was dumb luck and it was really Kathy's genius. And she met me in Lviv, and we traveled to Ivano Frankovic, and from there we went to the mountains. We spent a few days crawling around the mountains and seeing all the trails and understanding the lay of the land. She speaks fluent Russian. She was able to hire two Ukrainian guides, one a translator and tour guide, and the other a historian. And the four of us, we just became this little guerrilla unit, you know, recreating in our imaginations World War II. And I have to say, it was a wonderful experience. I mean, we had so much fun. And at the end of every night, of course, we didn't get sleep in a sleeping bag. We went to a tavern and had a few beers.
There you go. Well, the thing about it is that you make it a wonderful experience for the rest of us with your books. And we're again speaking with Stephen Hunter, the New York Times multi-bestselling author, the Bob Lee Swagger creator, and the book at present is Sniper's Honor. I do want to talk, Stephen, about a book that you've written that I have just found fascinating, your previous novel entitled The Third Bullet. And again, it's clear that you invested immense amounts of time in immersing yourself in the details of the Kennedy assassination and what seems to me is as persuasive an explanation of what actually happened in that episode as any, although it is supposed to be fiction. Talk a little bit about The Third Bullet.
Well, that was a book that I carried with me for 50 years. I'm old enough to have been a high school junior when Kennedy was killed, and I've never forgotten those 3 or 4 days and the trauma that it inflicted on this country and possibly my own generation. And I've sort of been in all the houses of assassination theory. I've been pro-Warren Commission and anti-Warren Commission. A few years ago, I began to get troubling nightmares about it, almost as if my programming was wearing off. And I decided to look at it. I thought it would be a kind of a neat idea for Bob Lee Swagger to investigate the Kennedy assassination. And I knew, frankly, from a commercial point of view, that the anniversary was coming up, and I thought I could get aboard that train. I mean, I'm not a commercial fool. And so I looked at it, and the more I looked at it, I just had alternative ideas. It seemed to me that the Warren Commission committed too early to a certain theory of the assassination. It was the most convenient theory of the assassination, and it's a pretty good theory that fits most of the data. But I'm not crazy enough to buy any of the Oliver Stone mega theories, but I tried to keep the data points that that were incontrovertible, keep them in their proper place, but find another way to them and to justify them from different points of view with different actions and different assumptions about the characters. There's no such thing as a big conspiracy. It's got to be a small conspiracy, 3 or 4 people. And that was kind of my operating principle. And I will tell you, it was so much fun.
I can only imagine. Listen, before I let you go, Stephen Hunter, talk a little bit about the super gun that Tracking Point has developed. Is this going to put snipers out of business?
Well, not immediately. I mean, it's any piece, particularly of electronic equipment, if you're going to use it in combat, it has to be rigorously tested and tried. And can it be made tough enough to stand up to a Marine PFC 5,000 feet up in the mountains of Afghanistan? I also suspect that there will be some reluctance from the sniper community. You know, snipers, the reason they do that work is because they love to shoot. They are good. It expresses them. That's what they want to do. They want to take that shot. They want to put themselves through the discipline and the incredible ordeal it takes to to make that shot. And so I think there's going to be some intrinsic resistance from within the culture.
Oh, I'm sure the sniper community won't be too keen on it. I just wonder whether the rest of the folks like me who can't shoot worth a darn would find it just incredibly empowering. We have to leave it at that. Stephen Hunter, I hope you'll come back soon. Don't feel the need to write another book just to get on our program. We'd love talking with you, and we look forward to doing so again. But in the meantime, congratulations on this brave, wonderful new book, Sniper's Honor. It's marvelous reading, and I'm anxious to finish doing it, so I'm going to get off the air quickly to get back to it. Thank you, Stephen. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk next with Hal Brands about grand strategy. Is there such a thing, and should we be pursuing it? Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change your mind.
They're not going to change your minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there. America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Frequently on this program, we talk about matters of strategy, ours and others. We will be, I'm sure, doing so in the course of this program as well. But I'm delighted to talk with somebody who's made a serious study of grand strategy. He is Professor Hal Brands, Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. He is the author, most recently, of What Good is Grand Strategy? Power and Purpose in American Statecraft, from Harry S. Truman to George W. Bush. It's a delight to have him with us to talk about it. Professor, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I've candidly not had a chance to read your book, but I'm very interested in the topic. Give us a flavor of, well, what good is grand strategy in your estimation?
It's potentially quite a lot of good. The debate about grand strategy tends to be very polarized between people who treat grand strategy as sort of a cure-all to all of America's foreign policy problems and people who tend to think that it is an illusion or that it's impossible to do. And so the purpose of the book is to bring the concept of grand strategy down to earth a little bit by explaining what it is and then what it can actually accomplish. And the basic argument is that grand strategy should be viewed as a collection of more or less coherent ideas about what a nation seeks to accomplish in the world and how it seeks to get there, and that if we look at a series of historical case studies from Harry S. Truman in the 1940s to George W. Bush after 9/11, we can see examples of administrations seeking to do grand strategy, and we can see what their successes and failures tell us about the prospects of grand strategy writ large.
We're talking with Dr. Hal Brand of Duke University about his new book, What Good is Grand Strategy? And the Practice of Grand Strategy by Ronald Reagan. What did you make of it?
Sure. I think Reagan's presidency is an example of how historical research can help us flesh out exactly what a grand strategy was and how it evolved and progressed over time. So one of the things that's become clear in looking at Reagan is that he was a serious strategic thinker, that he had spent lots of time grappling with Cold War strategic issues becoming president. And when he became president, he had a series of coherent grand strategic beliefs. He thought that the Soviet Union was weaker than it looked. He thought that the United States could put pressure on the Soviet Union by waging a geopolitical offensive on various fronts. And he thought that if it did that effectively, the United States could ultimately set the stage for a negotiated reduction of tensions on American terms. And if you look at the progression of Reagan's policies from 1981 to 1989, they are remarkably faithful to this vision. There was the taking shape of sort of the Reagan offensive during the early 1980s, and then there was a pivot to more diplomatic engagement from 1983-84 onward. And on the whole, I would say this is a very good example of an administration that set long-term goals, that had coherent ideas for how to accomplish them, and then was actually more or less able to turn those ideas into effective policies over time.
You know, I'm struck by that because my own feeling and personal experience of it was that the strategy that was adopted, as you say, sort of in the 83, maybe certainly by 84 in the Reagan administration, was one that was somewhat antithetical to the idea of destroying the Soviet Union, which was very much the centerpiece of, for example, National Security Decision Directive 75. And it seemed to me that what transpired in the end was that he succeeded by virtue of the power of the policies and strategy he exercised in particularly his first term, despite what came along afterwards rather than because of it. You seem to have the view that this is more of a piece, different techniques, of course, but that the second part, the bit about, you know, arms control negotiations and engaging with Gorbachev and so on, was really consistent with his early grand strategy. Do I understand you correctly?
Yes, I do think so. I think if you look at Reagan's radio commentaries from the 1970s onward, he had always been in favor of arms control. He had always been in favor of diplomatic engagement as long as that diplomatic engagement was consistent with American security interests as he viewed them. And his argument was that détente had not been consistent with American security interests. And I think if you look at NSDD 75, for instance, there is language in that document about promoting internal change within the Soviet Union. There's also language about seeking mutually beneficial diplomatic agreements with the Soviet Union in the area of arms control and in other areas as well. And so, absolutely, there was a current of opinion within the Reagan administration that argued that the United States should essentially seek the collapse of the Soviet empire. I think Reagan may have favored that goal over the very long term, but I think sort of his 5 to 10 year goal was essentially to put the United States back in a commanding geopolitical position and then use that leverage to reduce tensions with the Soviet Union in a way favorable to American interests. So I do see a greater degree of continuity there.
I guess this is a matter that we could debate indefinitely, but I'm my own feeling about it is that if he had maintained the sort of pressure of the first term, he might have succeeded even more in terms of unraveling the Soviet Union. But we will never know for sure. The concern I have is one that we're facing today and the grand strategy of a sort of reconstructed, if not Soviet Union, sort of imperial Russia that Vladimir Putin is building kind of on the ashes of a somewhat incomplete takedown of the old order. And I just would invite you, Professor Brand, and again, our guest is Hal Brand. He is an assistant professor of public policy and history at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University, to talk a little bit about some of the grand strategies that we are up against at the moment, maybe starting with that of Putin.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that, as you say, the Russian government would like to rebuild some of its former sphere of influence in the former Soviet Union and perhaps beyond. I think it's a little bit dangerous to assume that the other guy has a grand strategy when we don't. This is sort of a common fallacy in strategic thinking. But I do think that there is a substantial amount of evidence to suggest that the Russians would like to have some of the influence they have lost in that region. I think that this is a problem for us because the United States has an interest in not seeing the post-Cold War settlement in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union revised. That was a settlement that was quite favorable to our geopolitical interests. It was favorable to the spread of democracy. And so one of the key challenges for the United States is going to be to come to grips with what looks like an increasingly assertive tendency on the Russian part to use force, to use other coercive methods to restore Russian influence in these areas.
Do you see any evidence that the Chinese are being animated by other than a grand strategy of similar kind of expansionism, perhaps if only to shore up the Communist Party's position at home?
I think in general that is probably a fair assessment of what China's long-term aims are. It's always very difficult to do the sort of analysis of a grand strategy of an authoritarian regime that you would of a democratic regime. Because what's in many ways interesting about the United States is that we publish our grand strategy documents publicly in many cases, whereas authoritarian regimes tend not to. But I think if you look at the progression of Chinese foreign policy over the past 20 years or so, it's certainly been towards exerting more influence in Asia, both through diplomatic means, increasingly through military means, to some extent coercive means. And so again, this is an instance in which you have a country whose grand strategic interest seems to be in revising a regional order that has long been favorable to the United States. And so again, the grand strategic challenge for us is going to be to coordinate our response so that this order does not unravel over time.
Challenge indeed. We'll look forward to further visiting with you about whether we're up to it under present circumstances, but we appreciate your retrospective and study of this. Dr. Hal Brands, the author of What Good is Grand Strategy? Power and Purpose in American Statecraft from Harry S. Truman to George W. Bush. Thanks for your time today, and let's visit again soon. Next up, we'll talk with Andy McCarthy about, among other things, the fate of the free world. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Memorial Day has come and gone. For many of us, it's just the holiday that marks the beginning of summer with pools opening and schools closing. For some Americans, though, Memorial Day is truly a day of remembrance, of the service and sacrifice of millions of our countrymen and women in uniform. That service and sacrifice was often made necessary and far more costly, though, because of our nation's collective failure to recall past mistakes and to avoid repeating them. Instead, as we witness the emergence of the new Axis, comprised this time around by Russia, China, and Iran, we should bear this in mind. Weakness is provocative, and aggression provoked instead of deterred will likely mean that many more of us will face future Memorial Days mourning the needlessly lost. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We have Andy McCarthy joining us at the moment. He is, of course, among other things, a best-selling author. I anticipate shortly added to his list of Willful Blindness, The Grand Jihad, Spring Fever will be Faithless Execution, making the political case for the impeachment of Barack Obama. Andy McCarthy is, of course, also a federal prosecutor, now in retirement, but very much to his credit, great work in waging the war for the free world against enemies foreign and domestic. And it is a pleasure, as always, to have him with us. Andy, welcome.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks to be with you.
Well, you weighed in on a very sensitive subject among those of us who are concerned about the nature of one of those enemies, foreign and domestic, namely the Islamists. Daniel Pipes, a colleague and friend, in fact now a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy, has taken the position that there's evidence of some moderation among some in the Islamist camp. What are your views on that subject?
Well, I think no one has more respect for Daniel than I do, but what he sees is glimmers of hope. I see as, occasional aberrations in what otherwise is a downward trajectory. But, to me, that's kind of the secondary question. I ended up in response addressing a question which really wasn't central to what Daniel was writing about. Daniel was basically exploring, is there this phenomenon in Islamism of at least tilts toward moderation in some camps of it. My bigger concern, Frank, was assuming what Daniel said was true, what should be the U.S. policy response? And my conclusion is that, you know, we should ignore this potential development in Islamism, because the chance, and Daniel even says it's only a chance, that Islamism, which I take him to be Islamic supremacism or this agenda to implement Sharia principles, the chance that it would reform, however slight, is quite remote, I think. And in the meantime, we ought to be promoting the U.S. liberty agenda, which is antithetical to radical Islam and to Islamism, and we should be, to the extent we're reaching out to Muslims, we should be reaching out to authentic Muslim moderate reformers who want to get away from Sharia. So I would just hate to see more reason, which is like pushing on an open door with the Obama administration, you know, more reasons to give them to rationalize their outreach to all the wrong Muslims, which has been the biggest policy problem I think we've had for 20 years.
Yeah. Andy, just to sort of define terms for this purpose, isn't it kind of inherent in the very substance of the term Islamism that it does require an adherence to Sharia? And Sharia is, by definition, in turn, not a moderate force, not something that is prone to moderation or even modification, for that matter.
Well, I think, Frank, on your first point, it's absolutely true. It is by definition, Islamism is by definition about the implementation of Sharia. I think where things can get murky, and perhaps what Daniel is seeing, is some movement in some quarters of the Islamist camp on the matter of interpreting what Sharia requires. And to me, for American national security purposes, that's a very unsound road to go down. In my mind, we want people who see a bright line separation between Sharia as a personal moral compass, and that way, you know, however you want to construe it, as long as it's not a public policy imposition, that's fine, versus people who don't recognize a difference between the spiritual and the public space, and who want to impose Sharia principles, however benignly they choose to interpret them. And to me, that's what our bright line is. We have no good incentive to go down the road of any kind of collaboration with people who want to impose Sharia principles on the public square.
Yeah. This brings to mind a controversy that is now unfolding, in which a man who I've admired by and large and I personally like, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Mike Rogers of Michigan, has been induced to present the keynote address at an event on the 30th of May. I'm hoping that he will withdraw from that, but as of our conversation at the moment, he is not. This is a gala dinner for an organization called the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy that has had for some time, at the very best, Andy McCarthy, confusion about what you've just been talking about, whether we can embrace, Muslim brothers, for that matter, who clearly are all about Sharia, and do so safely. This event, on top of everything else, is supposed to be paying tribute to the proponents, the architects of the Ground Zero Mosque. Is this evidence of a certain, well, as you put it in one of your books, willful blindness or something else?
Well, it's certainly confusion. And, you know, look, I'm Chairman Rogers is a former FBI agent. There are, really good and really not so good FBI agents. I didn't follow his career, so I don't know which camp he fell into. But I do know that he was on the wrong side when five members of the House of Representatives, all conservatives, all Republicans, all who could really have used help from Chairman Rogers, stepped up to the plate and said that we need to look into the matter of Muslim Brotherhood infiltration in the U.S. government. They weren't asking for indictments. They weren't asking for anything other than inspector general investigations into the nature of the problem and also how in the world people with the connections of the type that we're talking about were able to get security clearances. And Chairman Rogers, who I think should have been in the camp supporting those five, was in the camp taking the other side of the question. So if he's now, you know, going to break bread with some questionable characters, I'm sorry to see him do that, but I can't say as I'm shocked.
Yeah. Well, part of the concern here is that one of the groups with which this so-called International Center for Religion and Diplomacy is involved is something called American Muslims for Constructive Engagement, whose purpose is, quote, the deliberate appointment of qualified Muslims to key advisory bodies and policy-relevant positions in government in order to shape U.S. policy choices, unquote, which,
you know,
pretty much
this
tracks with what the Brotherhood is about in their Civilization Jihad.
I think until we get and I don't really actually see this happening anytime soon, but until we get Washington to become something resembling a meritocracy and get away from all this tribal politics where, you know, the bean counters say we need a certain number of Muslims for this and a certain number of left-handed Irish Catholics for that, and, you know, let's not leave out the, you know, whatever. I just think this whole idea of atomizing our society and saying that you can't be representative of ideas unless you're a member of particular groups is a very left-wing, progressive, stupid way to go about policy. Liberty is blind, as justice is blind, when it comes to advancing its agenda. It doesn't organize itself according to ethnic numbers or racial numbers or anything like that. And I think until we get back to that as a society, back to that idea of merit and not groupthink, we're just gonna continue to have, you know, incoherence and largely silly policy.
Well, that's at best. Unfortunately, when the left's agenda, as you've so ably described it, Andy McCarthy, is exploited by their Islamist allies for actual subversive purposes, as you've documented in The Grand Jihad and more recently in Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy, I think we are really putting our country in peril.
You're quite right, and you're guaranteeing that you're going to get that outcome. If you say that, you know, we have to have certain groups at the table because they are members of these groups, then you're not interested in what their agenda is. You're having them at the table because they're with these groups.
Amen. And that's the problem. You got to be very alive to, especially to who those groups are. Anyway, way over time. Glad to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us as always. Next up, Gordon Chang on the latest out of Asia. It's astonishing. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, our duty expert and that of most other sentient beings on matters involving Asia. Gordon is, of course, a columnist with Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com. He is also frequently featured on Fox News commenting on matters involving Asia and our interests there. Gordon, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Let's start with India. You have written that this is a tectonic shift of sorts in the subcontinent and perhaps for much of the region surrounding it. Talk about this new prime minister's landslide and its implications.
Narendra Modi of the BJP won an absolute majority in the lower house of parliament which was not expected. People thought that his party would win, but not with this majority. And this is fantastic because it gives him the opportunity to start an economic revolution in India, which everyone expects him to do. The very interesting thing is that at his inauguration, he actually invited the Pakistani prime minister who attended. This is important because Narendra Modi, if he has one fault, and it's an enormous one, is that he is a Hindu nationalist and that he could engender, some people think, a communal fighting in India. But he did invite the Pakistani prime minister, and this is important because it shows the reconciliation that Modi is trying to create between India and Pakistan, and that means between India's Hindus and its Muslims.
Yeah. Do you think, despite what is his reputation in this regard, that he will be able to pull off domestically as well as with his relationship with the Pakistanis this kind of rather substantial improvement of relations?
I think that he's capable of doing it. Whether he actually does it or not is a different story. I think Modi realizes that as prime minister, he has responsibilities to all Indians, as he says, and that he is not going to fall back on Hindu nationalism, which is what people have really been worried about. And it's what the United States, the reason the United States denied him a visa about a decade ago. And relations between Washington and Modi have not been the best because we've been very concerned that he was trying to, if not sponsor the communal violence against Muslims, at least he was trying to aggravate it. I think that as prime minister, he will not do that, but that's only a hope.
Let me ask you about the India-Chinese relationship, Gordon Chang. This is, of course, another very important strategic challenge. And what is Narendra Modi's attitude towards the Chinese?
Well, Modi is a nationalist, so that means he is probably going to be much less tolerant of Chinese military incursions into Indian-controlled territory, like the one we saw last April at Ladakh, where the Chinese essentially camped out in Indian territory for basically 3-4 weeks. Many people say, and I think that's probably true, that India will want good relations with China because Modi will want economic development and he'll want help from Beijing. But I don't think he is going to be as solicitous as the Congress Party was before him. So I think we will see new relations between New Delhi and China. And I think that Modi will probably have better relations in the sense that the Chinese know that they will not be able to push him around.
There is this sort of Nixon goes to China kind of quality to Modi, we're told, that he may have opportunities because of his fairly hardline credentials to have a new beginning with some of these neighbors. And it will be very interesting to see whether he will recognize the peril from China and resist it or seek to engage in a kind of detente with Beijing. Speaking of detente, there seems to be none between China and Vietnam at the moment. Gordon, there's a report out that some 40 Chinese vessels surrounded a Vietnamese fishing ship today and rammed it. And it seems intended to inflame further the already rather testy relationship between the two nations, not least because of China's insertion of a large oil drilling platform in what is internationally recognized as Vietnam's exclusive economic zone. What's the latest on that, and where do you think it's headed?
Well, clearly a Vietnamese fishing craft was sunk. Fortunately, all of the crew on board was rescued. It appears that the Chinese intentionally rammed it without provocation. And so, therefore, this is another act of aggression on the part of the Chinese. This is very interesting because tomorrow our president is going to give a speech at West Point where he's going to outline his foreign policy for his last 2 years, and he's going to talk about the dangers of overreach. Well, right now, the danger is not the United States overreaching. The danger is that the United States is not going to resist China and Russia in their aggressive territorial moves. And so, therefore, this is going to be a very closely watched speech. I hope the president doesn't signal to Moscow and Beijing that they can do what they want. But that's what many people are afraid right now, especially because people are concerned that the United States is not going to be there to defend them as it needs to if we are going to continue our foreign policy that goes back for more than 200 years of defending freedom of navigation.
Gordon, this is a critically important part of the world for us as well as for allies and trading partners. I think you're absolutely right that the speech needs to be closely watched, but more important than the rhetoric is the actions, of course. And what worries me, as I know it does you and we've talked about many times, is the principal action taken by this administration seems to be the hollowing out of the military that will be the bulwark against this kind of aggression, whether it's from Russia or China or others for that matter, particularly the Western Pacific. We'll watch it closely, as will you. Gordon, let me turn to one other item that you've written about recently at Forbes.com, namely China's retaliation against the indictment by the United States of several government-tied, I guess, People Liberation Army officers involved in cyber attacks on American corporations. What exactly are the Chinese up to?
Well, the Chinese are retaliating against American companies for those five indictments handed down a week ago. It appears the Financial Times has reported that Beijing has ordered state enterprises to cut off their relationships with U.S. consulting companies. That would be McKinsey, Bain, and others. And now it appears it's going after IBM servers that banks, that Chinese banks have been employing in their networks. China has banned Windows 8 from operating systems of the central government. There's all sorts of things going on right now where this is economic retaliation against U.S. companies. It's a broad-based retaliation, and so the United States needs to respond because China's actions are clearly violative of its World Trade Organization obligations, and clearly the United States needs to protect its companies. We are going to need to see not only strong rhetoric, but strong action from the Obama administration because this hits the United States at a core of its strength, its economy.
Do you have a specific recommendation, Gordon, in terms of what we should be doing in that regard?
The president should call up Xi Jinping and say, look, if you don't cut this out immediately, we are not going to clear containers at the port of Long Beach, and those ships are going to be backed up 600 miles across the Pacific waiting to get into the United States. And that's just the start, buddy. I think that if this is not a question of trade rules, of course it is, but really this is going to be settled by an issue of raw power. The president needs to exercise it. He has the leverage. He just has not used it. This is the time for him to pivot, in a sense, and to show that he has some leadership and that he can defend American interests effectively.
Yeah, it's a challenge, of course, and the one that worries me most in all of this is whether the president actually recognizes the dangers that are associated with this kind of behavior for our economy, for our strategic interests, let alone whether he'll actually have the wherewithal to respond to the challenges in the way that you've just described, Gordon. And we'll be watching closely a speech that presumably will lay out some of his attitudes or policy directions against this backdrop at West Point in the days ahead. But it's a challenge that few understand as well as you do, and I hope that the White House is listening to what you're saying about it. Gordon Chang, as always, it's great to talk with you. Thank you for the help that you've given us on so many different fronts, and not least your appearances here each week. It's deeply appreciated. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week and talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.